Hello, and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about collected editions from the galaxy's greatest comic, 2000 AD. I'm Eamon Clark, and my guest for this episode got in touch with me by emailing mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Welcome to the book club, Matt Sharp.
Galactic greetings, Terrans.
Brilliant, spot on. So, Matt, thanks for being in the book club. We're going to get to your book choice in a minute, and it's an unusual one. But first, let's fill in a little bit of your character sheet with your 2000 AD origin story and your beginnings with the prog.
Right. My first prog was prog 211, which was bought to keep me quiet on a car journey on holiday to Yorkshire. The Battle of Upminster was what got me hooked.
Yep, classic Strontium Dog. That's obviously part of the Portrait of the Mutant series, which was running at the time.
Yep. And Jed was a bit atypical as he was in disguise and sneaking about.
So can you remember any of the other stories that were running in the prog at that time?
Bellardinelli's Wolfman in Meltdown Man was very impressive, but they were both in the middle of a story, so I was a bit baffled by it all. But on the previous year's holiday, I'd bought the 2000 AD Space Quiz Book, which is a paperback with the Mekon and the Space Shuttle on the cover, but it was rather difficult to see who it was aimed at. It's apparently aimed at 7 to 10-year-old boys, but includes questions on the man who fell to Earth.
Oh, right.
As well as 2000 AD-related Spot the Difference questions, mainly.
Oh, okay. I mean, I've heard about that one, but I've never actually seen a copy of the Space Quiz Book. As you say, they presumably were just pulling in questions from anywhere to fill copy, I should imagine.
Yeah, it's got more space facts than you can shake a stick at. I think it's the most obscure of obscure things.
So you got the odd prog here and there. When did you become a sort of regular reader of the prog?
I was pretty regular after prog 211, but it seems like I had a few before, because I found progs 185 and 187 in a cupboard when I was looking for an Asterix book, which I assume belonged to my older brother, but they might have been bought for me. And when I finally got hold of prog 154 with the Teeny Max on the cover, that was incredibly familiar. So I might have got that as well. I might actually have got that alongside the 2000 AD Space Quiz Book.
Right.
About six at the time, and I don't really remember.
Okay. Cool. So, and now do you get the prog, regularly now, or do you have a full collection?
Yep. I have a complete collection.
Excellent. So, let's get to the book we've chosen for Book Club. Tell us what we're going to be talking about in this episode.
Today we are going to be talking about the Judge Dredd role-playing game from Games Workshop and other things.
Excellent choice. Now, again, I have to commend you. I like it when people think literally outside the box, which in your case, we have got a literal box to think about. So well done for that. Let's talk about some of the facts and figures, first of all. So we're talking about the Games Workshop in 1985, I think. Is that right?
85, but I didn't get it till 87.
Right.
I had seen the Judge Dredd board game advertised in the 1984 Judge Dredd annual, and I nagged my parents to get that, which was didn't actually play that very much.
Right. It does have a very cool Brian Bolland cover, I believe, doesn't it?
Absolutely awesome Brian Bolland cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Ian Gibson board, which was very impressive, but it didn't play very well.
Right.
Because you could catch Judge Death littering, and the entire Angel Gang could subsequently turn out to be Nikita Kram in disguise, but then the entire gang could turn out to have been Edwin Parsley all along.
Okay.
I always wondered who Mad Tooth McKill was, because I hadn't got the 1981 Judge Dredd annual at the time, and I probably wouldn't have read the text story in it anyway.
Right.
He's a quite obscure character to put in there.
Okay, so that was the board game. But as we say, we've got this role-playing game. Now, I don't have the full box set. I've just got the two game players' books. So that's the Judge's Manual and the Game Master's book. I can see from them that this was... So we've got a cover by Terry Oakes, who I'm not familiar with, but I gather from my research he was a Games Workshop artist rather than a 2000 AD artist.
Yep, I think he appeared in White Dwarf quite often.
Yes, I think so. If you Google him, I think White Dwarf tends to crop up quite a bit, which obviously was the... Is White Dwarf still going as a Games Workshop publication?
I'm not sure what form it's in. I think it still exists.
Right.
So it seems to be... Last time I saw it, it was a weekly.
Right.
It was always monthly when I got it.
Okay, so, I mean, it was, you know, it was the... It was the great magazine for game players at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got, just again, some more names. We've got a game system designed by Rick Priestley, it tells me, with background 2000 AD information and editing by Mark Gascoigne. And the whole thing was produced by Angus Ryle. Again, I presume most of these are Games Workshop names. And as I say, it's 1985. Now, I confess, Matt, that I have not played any of the games that we're going to be talking about tonight. I'll tell you my experience score. I used to play a bit of Dungeons & Dragons and Traveller, but at some point in the early 80s, off I went to university and I stopped, I'm afraid, and haven't played anything since. So can you, if anybody else is unfamiliar with role-playing games, can you fill us in just like a few background details on how they work?
Yep, well, a very basic guide to role-playing. Each player has a player character, a judge in the case of Judge Dredd, who they make the decisions for. One person in the team is the games master. He controls everything else in the universe, describing what PCs' surroundings, describing what non-player characters, NPCs, are doing and saying, above all, telling a story. All characters have a set of statistics. In Judge Dredd's case, these are basically a set of skills, combat skill, drive skill, tech skill, street skill, and medical and side skill, that have a percentage chance of doing something, and a pair of physical characteristics, strength, which had a range between 1 and 3 and was a measure of your endurance as well as your physical power, and initiative, another percentage-based characteristic, which measured how fast you could react to things as well as being a catch-all to cover things that players might attempt to do that isn't covered by other skills. Initiative also determines how many actions characters can take in a 10-second combat round, and also gets diminished whenever the character gets injured, so that you can take fewer actions when you're injured. Actually, my favourite part of the system, most RPG characters are either fully functional or dead. Judges gain experience over time in the form of extra points added to their initiative or skills. Psi skills could only be increased if you're already a psi judge, and strength couldn't be improved at all. Any character that managed to get a skill to go above 40 would gain a special ability related to that skill.
So you've got a games master who's designed a sort of scenario or campaign that the players are going to take part in. The players, as you say, have rolled dice and created their own individual judge characters who are going to presumably work together as a group of judges or a squad of judges in order to try and sort of work their way through the scenario. What else came in the box apart from the two books that I've mentioned?
In the box, there was the Games Master's book and the Judge's Manual, which is the books.
Yep.
A load of cardboard cutout figures, which didn't last very long from my box set. The box set itself disintegrated quite quickly. A double-sided floor plan and a set of polyhedral dice, which included a regular six-sided dice, a 12-sided dice known as a D12, and a 20-sided dice, and a pyramidal four-sided dice, which you should avoid leaving on the floor under any circumstances, in case somebody stood on it in bare feet, which was bad.
Yes, role-playing games introduces us to the wonderful world of different types of dice, and they're fabulous items when you go to buy them in the shops. I remember being sort of like entranced by them when I was a youngster, and still when I see them in Games Workshop, they can be look shiny, jewel-like things, can't they?
Yes, that's right. I remember buying several sets of... complete sets of polyhedral dice, but always losing the eight-sided one. So I had to buy another set because you couldn't buy them individually, apart from D20s.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about... Let's start with the Judge's Manual then. We've got the Judge's Manual, which is basically the player of the games, their guide to creating characters and then using the characters. What can we find in this book?
Right. The judge's manual begins with details of character creation and listing the standard equipment carried by all judges, including extensive details of the lawgiver pistol and the lawmaster bike. This is followed by the basics of how to play the game, combat rounds, how the judges and NPCs move about and how they hit things. In the third chapter, making arrest, while the fourth chapter, other actions, details other, mainly non-combat-based actions a judge can perform in a combat round, such as detailing other types of movement actions, climbing, swimming and sneaking about, vehicle rules and breaking things. On in chapter 5, on patrol, gives the, some details of patrolling the city on foot as well as on the roads, along with sentencing guidelines once the judges have arrested someone, and gives the idea of the adjustment, an idea of the Justice Department rank structure and that what goes, what backup they might be able to call on. Once a judge manages to increase a skill above 40, he gains a special ability chosen from an extensive list in chapter 6, special abilities. And the book ends with a couple of chapters of background material. Chapter 7 is a judge's guide to Mega City 1, detailing life in the city and including a history up to the then current year of 2107. And the final chapter is a glossary of Mega Speak.
Okay, so plenty of info for the judges and for the players who are actually going to be playing this group of judges. Obviously, the Game Master's book is a slightly thicker affair because the judges is almost... the manual is almost like just a slightly beefier issue of the magazine in a way, in terms of size. What about the Games Master's book? This is where things get much more complicated, because the Games Master obviously needs to know much more about the world of the judges, the mega city, and I suppose the scenario or campaign that they've designed for the players. There are some that you could buy off the shelf.
A few, yes. Well, the Games Master is in charge of everything else in the world that isn't player characters, so it's much harder work.
Yes.
It starts with an introduction chapter, which explains about role-playing, Games Mastering and the world of Mega City 1. Most of the subsequent chapters detail pretty much the same material as the stuff in the Judges Manual, except it explains how to deal with everything else in the scenario rather than what one character is doing. It also emphasises that the judges are supposed to take prisoners alive, if at all possible, with the extensive challenge and surrender rules. Because most fantasy role-playing games require the players to wade through armies and armies of goblins before they get any skills at all.
Right, OK. No goblins particularly in this game.
You could put goblins in if you wanted to.
I suppose, yeah, when we get to the horror scenarios, yeah.
There was also a brief scenario based on the wreckers strip from 2000 AD, a short, straightforward combat and heavy encounter that used the vehicle and combat rules.
Right.
There are several chapters dealing with the types of perp citizens and robots the judges will encounter whilst on patrol, as well as their weapons, equipment and vehicles, and the city block and sectors that they live in. A whole host of famous characters are detailed in Chapter 6, not least which is Judge Dredd himself, with villains including the Angel Gang and the Dark Judges. Naturally, meeting any of the Dark Judges is not recommended at all, as they can kill with a single touch. The book ends with a longer but still fairly basic scenario called The Ultimate Crime of Tony Thermo.
Yes, which sort of gives you the flavour of how a scenario would run for a games master and a group of judges. And of course, it would let a novice games master actually have something to do for the first adventure, I guess, wouldn't it?
Yep, it was quite a decent scenario that you could get it done in a couple of, about an hour and a half it took us.
So when you first started with the Judge Dredd role-playing game, was it a group of 2000 AD fans, or was it a group of sort of like gaming fans that you were doing these scenarios with?
Well, no. I attempted to get my friends to join a game, but no luck. But somebody mentioned that their next door neighbour, who was a year above us, was a role player, and he also had the Judge Dredd game. So I was able to get into a gaming group that way.
Oh, right. OK, so he was the games master, was he? Or was there someone else doing the games mastering?
He was the games master.
Right.
And he couldn't get anybody to play Judge Dredd, so he was handy I came along. He was also 6'5", and he was 14, so he's quite impressive.
Okay. And what happened then? So you started out basically on the other side of the Games Master's shield. You were the judge.
Yes, I created a character who went by the exciting name of Jones.
Rookie Judge Jones.
He was actually a qualified judge.
You start
qualified judge. You don't. You wouldn't get to be a rookie unless the games master wanted to play you as a complete introduction. So you started out as a fully qualified judge as soon as you were created. It's assumed you've already done all the Academy of Law and the rookie runners, whatever.
Okay. And were you playing other games like Dungeons & Dragons and Traveller at this time, or were you particularly interested in the Judge Dredd world?
Well, I'd played a couple of games of Dungeons & Dragons, the Red Box Basic set, but we hadn't really got it. We treated it like a board game with monsters in rooms, and I hadn't realised there was one player told the story and the other players were characters in the story, which made a lot more sense once I'd worked out that out from the judge's manual.
And then at some point, obviously, you went from being a judge yourself to actually coming up with your own scenarios as a games master for Judge Dredd?
Not for a while. In the introduction, we played an introductory adventure, and I realised after Jones was charged with tracking down a pair of muggers and it ended up with them cornered in a warehouse. Jones apprehended one, but another escaped and what the games master described as a power board, which he thought was some sort of skateboard, and was annoyed with me because Jones wasn't chasing him on his law master because I thought he'd flown away. I subsequently explained that a power board was actually a flying surfboard, but it was clear that he knew a lot about role-playing, but he didn't know anything about Judge Dredd. Clearly, I was required to spread the word of Tharg and needed to lend him some old progs to give him an idea of the setting.
Oh, right. So when you looked to the progs and the stories to bring in to, your experience of role-playing and to teach others about Judge Dredd, what sort of stories were you using?
By then, I'd obtained a back prog. Prog 205, which has 2000 AD's only cover of a homicidal polar bear.
Yes, I know the one.
Yep, because Shaco never got a cover that Polax from Meltdown Man did.
Yes, I've been looking at that prog today.
Yes.
So tell us about the Dredd story in that one, because that's particularly important, isn't it?
Yep, Alone in a Crowd, which is practically a role-playing game scenario on its own. I also had the story in the 2000 AD monthly, but for that particular issue, I've been inspired by the tale of Mark Sheridan of Auckland, New Zealand in the 1982-2000 AD, and you who coloured in every issue. I'd coloured everything in with colouring pencils, but it took ages and it looked awful. I wasn't going to let anybody else look at it. Hopefully Mark Sheridan got better results.
Okay. But what was it about the Alone in a Crowd story that was so good for role-playing?
Yeah, it actually echoed the first adventure. Dredd traces down a group of tap dancers or muggers, although it has Dredd on his lawmasters when he's patrolling a pedestrian area.
You want
to keep judges off the lawmasters as much as possible in the RPG because it's a ridiculous amount of firepower.
Okay, too powerful.
Yeah, much too powerful. Yeah, it's also got stunning art. But I think it's Dylan's first published Dredd tale, although I think the story in a sci-fi special predates it. I'm not sure.
Right. I mean, certainly in terms of Steve Dylan artwork, the story Alone in a Crowd from Prog 205 is just fabulous, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful. And it was considering he was about 18 or 19 at the time, it's astonishing. He's there. He's just straight away there.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, it's the same year. It's still the sad loss of Steve Dillon earlier this year. Dreadful loss to the 2000 AD world.
That was a shock, that one.
Yeah. Okay, so you had that story to show to your gaming friends. What else did you use for giving them the wonders of Dredd's world?
Right. I used the longer story as an example of a campaign, which is a collection of scenarios to make a longer story, which was the graveyard shift from progs 335 to 341.
Right. Classic Dredd.
Classic awesome Dredd.
Yep.
Another story where we follow Dredd on a regular patrol, a single ordinary night shift, although it does admit it's actually quite a busy one.
Yes, it is.
As an introduction to the world of Dredd, it's got pretty much everything you need to know about the judges, the citizens, perps, and even the city itself. in just 7 episodes. Dredd deals with several footsies. A Jude Rumble actually turns up too late to help, but it's early yet. A Leafer, he's too late again. Forget the H-Dragon, make it a catch-up clean-up squad. Murder of a Judge, a hold-up robbery, a passing Boinger. An underground bite-fighting ring, performs several crime blitzes, gets involved in a block war that eventually results in the collapse of 2 entire city blocks, tracks down a spree killer and avoids doing any paperwork.
Of course, yeah.
There's also a mention of a ton of things Dredd doesn't personally deal with. Mutant incursions, a sniper-based traffic hazard, a mob blitz, a major spacecraft crash, an escaped alien monster that eats at least 17 citizens, and a major outbreak of food poisoning with contaminated food. My favourite bit is the request of somebody to deal with a domestic incident at Larry Hagman Connaps that no one's response to in episode 1. Then we get a report of things have escalated to include an entire level 9 and several fires have broken out by episode 2. Rescue efforts are being hampered by a sonic cannon. At the start of episode 3, the entire Connap is ablaze, with the rest of the South Fork estate having an impromptu barbecue. It's the best blaze they've seen since Power Tower went up, which Dredd witnesses as a glow on the horizon before finally we see a gutted ruin with the reports of 3,350 deaths.
Right.
The eventual death toll of the entire story is over 100,000 citizens, and the night is only quite busy. And it includes several guest starring roles for the entire supporting cast at the time, which was at the time 3. Hershey briefly joins Dredd on patrol before getting lumbered with the paperwork, and Magruder and Anderson each appear for a couple of panels. It also shows Mecha Sidhuan at its most callous. Stuart, who looks a bit like Dave Gorman off the channel Dave, rings up to a vid show to complain he's lonely, but quickly gets cut off because the audience decide he's boring. He subsequently jumps out of a window to his death, which at least attracts an appreciative crowd.
So, tell me, the graveyard shift, obviously, you know, as you said, it's got all these features, all these bits and pieces going on. It's one of the classic Dredd stories. It's one of the stories that's been mentioned recently as being, you know, possibly an inspiration for the upcoming TV show. How did it fit in well for the sort of role-playing sort of world and introducing people to the, you know, the stuff of Dredd and Mega City 1?
Well, it actually shows quite a lot of Sector 44. There's a couple of panels in the Undercity, and as well as giving a brief glimpses of the interior of the Justice Department itself.
Right.
Yeah, there's medwagons and forensic teams working, and even pathology work taking place on a conveyor belt, and as well as the regular street judge action. Side division gets a look in.
Right, yeah. As you said, Anderson appears for a couple of panels as well.
Yeah. It also, although it does seem to have the definitely deaded in the Apocalypse War Judge X in charge.
Oh, right, yeah.
It also does a great job of getting the sheer scale of the city across. There's a panel at the start of Judge Dredd in a watching bay, and it goes on for miles.
Yes. And it's Ron Smith art, I think, isn't it?
I think it's my favourite Ron Smith art because it just looks massive.
Yes.
He drives above the Statue of Judgment and the Statue of Liberty at one point on an aerial roadway.
Yeah, I mean, if you want somebody to show the sheer size and complexity and the weirdness of Mega City 1, Ron Smith's your man, isn't he?
He is.
Okay, so, you know, you use these stories to deliver a bit more of the world of Dredd to your gaming group, but at this point you're still a player judge. You've not switched to Games Master yourself. And were you getting a few more players coming in?
Yeah, we gained another couple of players by then.
Oh, good, right.
And the setting was more established in the mind of the Games Master as well. Jones gradually began to gain experience.
So Judge Jones is learning his craft on the streets, getting more and more experienced.
Yep, but I decided to focus on one skill alone, which was his initiative, because I wasn't a particularly experienced role player.
Okay. So if his initiative improves, what sort of things does that allow him to do better in the game, and what's the downside of just concentrating on one factor?
Well, the Judge Dredd role-playing game requires a more balanced character, really. So he was very fast and tough, but almost failed whatever he required to do. He was required to use another skill. He could five points in a round, but he rarely ever hit anything.
Right.
He bodged every tech skill he was ever required to make. Nobody ever took the slightest notice of him when he asked them to surrender. And he always left his driving to the Lawmaster. I don't remember him facing any psi-based skills, but you're pretty sure he would have failed them as well. But as you couldn't increase your psi skill unless you're a psi judge, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. So.
Okay. And what happened to Judge Jones? Did he carry on in the campaigns, or did he go out in a blaze of glory?
You know, I don't remember.
Oh, right.
I don't remember. I think he either fell off a city block or was involved in a vehicle collision, which is both capable of causing hundreds of hits.
Right.
I suppose he might have been gunned down by an anonymous punk, because it's actually possible in the Judge Dredd role-playing game to get killed with a single shot, but it's no matter how powerful you are. But you really ought to remember how my first character died, but I don't. So
what next? Is it another character, or is it time to start designing your own scenarios?
I had a second character come along, Judge Jekyll.
Oh, okay.
But the first rules expansion came out at then, so with a Judge Dredd companion. It's a bit of a mixed bag, really. There's revised rules governing player character strength scores and hand-to-hand combat.
Right.
Rather irritatingly, statistically speaking, any newly created judge using the system would have a greater chance of having the lowest possible score rather than a 50% chance of being average as per the original rules. There were massively improved vehicle rules, but they were still absolutely lethal. Some new special abilities, which was quite a lot of them were things that Jones could do anyway. And one that was completely useless and rather annoying, where you gave your judge two heads.
And right.
He fell from the city, even though he had an initiative of 40 to get that. So why would you want to do that?
Yes, indeed.
And there were also rules for superheroes.
Okay.
Which were mainly useful because it had lots of superhero-type equipment. A crime blitz random generation table, in case you wanted to run some 59Cs.
Yes.
On your city blocks. Details of some megacity crazies, including botting and gaxing, where you were pretended to be monsters or adventurers for some reason. A rather excellent campaign setting called Downtown.
And right.
Rules for the Exorcist Squad alongside paranormal enemies. There's also a solo game book style adventure to introduce players to the setting by some bloke called Jason Kingsley.
Oh, right.
He's got a special thanks credit in the main book too, but I think that's which I think is his first 2000 AD related credit. And he's subsequently appeared in everything that's appeared on your show so far. So.
Oh, right. So that's Jason Kingsley of Rebellion.
I assume so.
Yeah.
We're mass producing Jason Kingsley at some point.
And when did that companion come out? Is this late 80s or...?
I think it was 89.
Right.
8 or 89.
Blimey, his first credit.
Well, he's credited with a special thanks in the main rulebook as well. And there's a Judge Kingsley as an example of play somewhere in the player's book as well. So whether that's him or not, I don't know.
And did the companion, the Judge Dredd companion then... add anything to your sort of your own player character of Judge Jekyll?
Well, he was created with the new he had a higher strength than Jones,
right?
But it wasn't really that much different game wise because quite a lot of the book was just seemed to be filling pages. There's a Brits at the High School that says nothing, and there's a cut out board game based on Blockout from the 1984 sci-fi special that's pretty much just snakes and ladders.
Oh, right, okay.
It might have been better than that. We never played it. But the rest of it was adventures, which is a few page, one-page adventure seed ideas. And the the Channel 9 Crime Time special, which was quite a fast-moving and fun-to-play game, and but Fear and Loathing in Megacity 1, based on Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It was massively complicated plot, based on a huge backstory that the judges have little or no chance of discovering. Attempting to run that one involved everyone getting annoyed and confused.
Right.
Perhaps we needed to be better role players. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that was a bit of a disappointment to end it on.
So I'm keen to get on to the bit where you're designing your own scenarios and becoming a games master yourself. When did that happen for you?
Right. After a while, we'd run the scenarios in the companion, and then I was keen to be... I'd become more experienced as a role player, and I was keen to try my hand as a games master. But fortunately, our regular games master was keen to try being a judge.
Ah, okay.
Right. Now, I was the master. Everyone rolled up some new judges, and I set my stories in a different sector. Sector 119 on the southwest corner of the city, adjacent to the city wall. We'd previously been playing in Sector 44, which is where Dread is usually based.
Right, okay. And what was the sort of basic outline of your first sort of scenario or campaign for your players?
Right. I'd drawn a map, but the 150 city blocks I detailed and it ignored the details given in the strip, which makes out there really ought to be 19 and a bit city blocks in per sector, which the artists quite often ignore as well. So I wasn't that bothered. Most of my scenarios were set in two blocks. The Henry Ford block, which, aka the Big H, was a brand new state-of-the-art city block, the tallest building in the sector, where the more sophisticated crimes occurred, and its neighbour was the much more run-down Billy Pratt block. Not quite a slum, but getting there where all the weird stuff happened.
Right, okay.
I based my campaign on a bitter struggle between a pair of rival mob bosses. No Face Al Capek, with a bionic head and a featureless face, backed up by a small army of robot mooks, who was trying to muscle in on the territory of the more traditional Orson Cart.
Oh, of course, yeah.
A name which I stole shamelessly and without regret from a minor character in Robo Hunter.
Ha ha.
Who had a much larger but considerably flimsier army of human mooks.
So it's a turf war between two mobs. So shall we get to talking about some of the horror elements from the strip and how you were able to incorporate those into the role-playing game and the campaigns?
Okay, I soon got the rhythm of it. Gradually introducing reoccurring characters, beginning with the Blitz agent Vladimir Dunbar, who spoke stereotypical Irish Barney with an outrageous cod Russian accent, Tucker the Trucker Drucker, a narc based on Ace Garp, who the judges would actually go to great lengths to avoid speaking to as they made him so annoying, as well as Orson Cart's sinister lawyer, young Mr. Down of the esteemed law firm Down, Down, Deeper and Down, who spent most of his time encased in a suspended animation chamber and was only awoken to get involved where the money was right. Not to mention No Face Owl's even more sinister lawyer, Old Man Down, senior partner of the law firm Down, Down, Deeper and Down, who was a disembodied brain and eye suspended in a goldfish bowl with a bowler hat balanced on top, all sitting on top of a thin mechanical body apparently made from metal tubes and the inside of an old typewriter. A cross between Harold Quartz from Robusters and Bonnie Crickle, nice, ratty, from Error of Judgment.
So that was the setting for that campaign. Move us on a little bit and tell us a little bit about the horror element.
Right. Following an incident where I'd accidentally made a character much too powerful.
I guess if you've got robotic characters, it can be, easy to make them too powerful for the player judges. As you say, in the original game system, the Lawmaster bikes were probably too powerful. And as a games master, you wanted to keep the judges on foot as much as possible. Otherwise, it just, I suppose, becomes a shooting match.
Some of the perps were quite overpowered as well. There was one time... The judges arrived on the scene of a mob blitz in a Skyrail station, and
this was the one that you based on the Odessa step sequence from the film, The Untouchables.
Yeah, I'd chanced on the idea of using disguised wrestling droids as Terminator-style assassins, but they turned out to be much more powerful than I intended. The judges arrived at the scene of a mob blitz in a Skyrail station, which was based on the Odessacept scene in The Untouchables. They managed to rescue some bystanders. He even took out a couple of Orson Karts mob enforcers, but the Robo Mook tore through the blitzer surrounding a numbers runner without taking a scratch. It was at this point I realised that the wrestling droids detailed in the Games Master's book were based on Precious Leglock from Mega City, had massive armour everywhere and were practically indestructible.
Right, okay. Not great for an RPG then.
No, he managed to turn his attention to the judges. He snapped one's arm with no effort, wounded another with a kick to the abdomen, and then finally punched one in the chest, shattering his sternum and knocking him through a ticket booth, which killed him, much to the annoyance of the player.
Yes, I bet. Yeah. Nobody likes to have their character suddenly killed off in an instant by a robot.
It's not too bad as long as it's reasonably dramatic, which that was. Being punched through a wall is generally quite dramatic, I've found.
Yep.
The judge with the broken arm was able to blast the platform away from under the rampaging behemoth bot, so that he tumbled onto the Skyrail tracks, where he was subsequently smashed into by a conveniently passing Zoom train, which was moving at a couple of hundreds of kilometres an hour, which is the Games Master attempting to bring a surprising turn of events to a sudden close.
Yeah, that works. You can see that in a film or in a comic strip, this train suddenly destroying the robot. Yeah,
but the players insisted I roll for damage and he survived.
Oh, okay.
It was quite badly damaged, dragging itself back onto the platform with its single remaining arm.
Yep.
Which rather shocked the surviving judges. The other player had gone off into the garden to sulk, as is the tradition. But fortunately, it was sufficiently damaged to be vulnerable to their lawgiver shots, and finally fell to a general purpose round to its computer brain.
Right.
I'd learned something, though. I need to be more careful choosing opponents. No Fakes Owl lost all his wrestling droids all of a sudden, and took to using lobotomized, bionically enhanced corpses stolen from Recycler's Blitzers. But if I could scare the players, I could produce a more memorable story.
Oh, right. Okay, so how did you go about scaring them?
I decided to add more horror elements to the campaign. Orson Karts gained a demon-summoning cult as allies to counter the opposition's practically indestructible assassin robots. The players gained some backup in an idea taken from the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. The second edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, henchmen provided extra fire and pack backup. The team was joined by an inexperienced but irritatingly enthusiastic rookie, whose name I can't remember, and a bitter and cynical side judge known as Lazy Lowenstein, who was played by a terrible impersonation of Bela Lugosi, but only because I wasn't able to do an terrible impersonation of Peter Lorre.
Right. Okay. So these are sort of assistants for the player characters, but you operate them.
Yeah. Usually, they could also be taken over by the players in the event of their main character getting killed or severely wounded, which happens
right.
a lot.
A bit of backup. Yes.
Yes. Which was quite seriously needed at this point. I set about designing a more horrific campaign that included the spring-heeled jackalike demonic Mr. Hobb and the cult of Zabadak Alcala Okora Makalakak.
Easy for you to say.
You'd think that. That was take 97, by the way. But first, I needed to introduce more details of the mysterious side division to the judges. So I lent them some more progs, which was The Haunting of Sector House 9 from prog 359 to prog 363.
Now, again, another classic Dread story, which I'm guessing most of our listeners will be familiar with. And, you know, a great spooky story for Dread. Introduces all sorts of horror and psychic features. And I suppose a great introduction for your players to actually, you know, get to grips with some of the psi elements of Dread's world.
Yeah, as an introduction to Psi Division, it works pretty well.
And tell us about the artwork on that story.
It's a genuinely creepy horror story. It has absolutely beautiful Brett Ewing's artwork, which is probably his best work on Dread.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
It starts off in a normal normal day in a sector house. In the first splash panel, there's all these weirdos wandering about. There's the relatively ordinary middle-aged woman who's lost Fluffy the Robo Terrier, and the clock-obsessed citizen Scoot Beck, who's lost his shoulder clock. And then it gets increasingly weird. It gets increasingly claustrophobic, with blood dripping from the walls forming into hands and eyes and mouths. And it's filled with unforgettable images, from the scene in the morgue with the dead Judge Drucker's eyes flickering open before he rises up, becoming a bizarre, twisted thing with two mouths turning against his comrades. And the unfortunate Amcor, who is forced to attempt to flee from a med bay by jumping out of a window while he's on fire.
Yes.
Which is impressive.
Yeah, impressive stuff. Okay, so you've given your players The Haunting of Sector House 9 as a great, you know, horror story for them to read. And then how did you work that into the campaign? You've mentioned, you know, the weird cult and this sort of Spring-Heeled Jack-like character.
I introduced paranormal entities into the RPG campaign, which they encountered standing at the top of a flight of stairs in a warehouse, mutilated bodies at his feet, cloaked in shadows and dressed in old-fashioned tattered Victorian clothing. His face was so pale it was almost blue and cracked like old dry mud, grinning an impossibly wide, rictus grin of pointed shark-like teeth. His eyes at first a dull scarlet glow, becoming more and more intense as he stared at them, flaring like fan embers until they burned like a furnace. He seemed to have knives in his hand, but they realised they were claws, dripping in blood and gore. Then he started to giggle.
Hmm. Okay, you've set the scene. How did the players get on with this?
They shot him. The being known as Mr. Hobb, who's a combination of Spring-Heeled Jack from London mythology and the creature from Quatermass in the Pit, escaped, as he was immune to bullets, even their regular backup go-to when all else failed, high X.
Did they ever track him down and finish him off, or did he return to haunt them again and again?
He became something of a reoccurring villain. But when they found out he was actually vulnerable to incendiary ammunition, he became much easier to deal with and escaped into a sewer, which all role-playing games have seen set in a sewer at some point. And fortunately for them, their assistant, Side Judge Lowenstein, was able to track him down by following his psychic spoor.
Of course, yeah.
Down to a roughly hewn tunnel, which led down into the Undercity, which was just another excuse to lend him another batch of progs.
Oh, right. So what did you move on to then? What stories was that?
That was Cry of the Werewolf from Prog 322 to 328.
Classic.
Right. You all know what happens in that. How are things down there, Prager? Grim. If yes. I hadn't included Cry of the Werewolf, I would have been failing to properly spread the word of Tharg, I think.
Yes, I believe when I asked Matt Smith at the 40th anniversary bash for his favourite moment from 40 years of Judge Shred, I believe he did choose Cry of the Werewolf as his. And again, it's Steve Dillon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Moody shadows everywhere, absolutely. A lot of it, I never noticed at the time, but both the judges and the werewolves are mainly just silhouettes.
Yeah.
When they're in the city. When the judges arrive, they're just their headlights and shadows, and the werewolves are all glinting teeth in emerging from the darkness onto various people that they murder. And it's also got an astonishing transformation scene where Corcoran, strapped down to a chair, mad eyes glowing as his teeth elongate, tearing through the surrounding judges and medical staff until Dredd smashes his teeth out with a well-aimed headbutt.
Yes. Dredd does things like that.
Yes. Oh, amazing piece of work. Although I admit my 9-year-old self was distinctly miffed that his teeth were intact once again once he turns back into a human.
Ah, right. Difference between werewolf teeth and human teeth. Cry of the Werewolf, that's somewhere in the 300s, isn't it, in the progs?
322 to 328, I think it is.
Ah, splendid. Good. You've got the facts and figures.
I have it in front of me. The very progs in front of me themselves.
Excellent stuff. What did your players make of that, of Cry of the Werewolf?
They were very impressed. They loved that one. That was their favourite one, I think.
But, right.
That selection of progs also has the Alan Moore Time Machine story in it, which impressed them even more, which is... And they were talked about that a lot more.
Right. There's great stuff going on in the prog around this time, of course. 80s golden age.
Yep. Prog 324 is one of the best progs I remember.
Okay. So you've got them down in the Undercity. Are they still on the trail of your Springheel Jack character, Mr. Hobbs?
Yep. They began their descent into the buried world of the Undercity, which is... even though the progs had only ever set things in New York beneath Sector 44, I decided that other sectors had under cities underneath them as well, because I was the games master and what I say goes.
Yep, those are the rules, yes.
And, yeah, but they were able to pursue Mr. Hobbs' psychic spore through the city, the buried city, to a ruined cathedral, encountering on the way groups of vicious but completely ineffective Morlock-like proggies, a band of renegade robots who escaped from the city during the Robot Rebellion, and a small army of block maniacs left over from the Apocalypse War who fled when the nukes started falling, but had become so wrapped in fighting the various Undercity inhabitants that they'd never bothered to go home again.
Right, yep. Again, that well-worn trope of the unit that thinks the war is still going on even after it's long finished.
Yeah, they used quite a lot of ammunition getting through them.
Checking it off on their character sheets as they go, presumably.
When I reminded them to, that get forgotten accidentally.
Yes.
They eventually found a ruined cathedral with strange obsidian stones that had been erected in a great circle, and a black-clad cultist of Zavadak Alcala Accord or Macalacac could be seen performing a terrible human sacrifice. As the judges ran forward to try to save the unfortunate victim, huge bloodshot eyes opened in each of the standing stones, and a terrible impenetrable darkness descended on the chamber, freezing the judges in their tracks. A terrible formless being began to form in the centre of the darkness as the head cultist raised his sacrificial knife above his head. Fortunately, one of the judges managed to make his sigh save and blasted the cultist with an incendiary round, because he's otherwise completely run out of ammunition, because he'd got through 120 rounds going through the block maniacs, which was quite an achievement. Probably let them take the law masters with them on that occasion. they'd never run out of ammunition before or after, so it wasn't my fault.
Right.
The potential victim was saved, but unfortunately, the dread shadow entity was just as satisfied with one of his own followers burning to death.
That sounds like horrific entities and what they do.
Darkness emerging from the shadows. Fortunately, the beginning of the manifestation broke the psychic hold on the judges, allowing them to act. They subdued the remaining cultists with a stun grenade, but were at a loss how to fight the insubstantial darkness entity. I didn't tell them, but they were supposed to blow up the obsidian standing stones, but they'd forgotten about them in the action.
Ah, okay. And this was before the Judge Dredd and Johnny Alpha story Judgment Day, which might have given them a clue if that had come out, before this story.
That was 1989, this would have been.
Yeah.
That was quite a long time. They were facing the dreaded team wipe, which is best avoided if at all possible.
Right.
So, fortunately for them, Side Judge Lowenstein stepped forward and was able to contain the extra-dimensional form within his mind. And then he explained the rest of the plot, and they were able to blow up the standing stones and end the scenario. But the unfortunate Judge Lowenstein was dragged back into another dimension.
Oh no!
Which was quite a dramatic end for a non-playing character.
Side Judge Lowenstein didn't make it to the end.
Yes, and his accent went almost but not quite entirely unlike Welsh at the end, unfortunately, because I'm usually pretty consistent with Transylvanian. He did turn up in a Call of Cthulhu scenario that I ran as a shambling grey-skinned corpse in tattered black and green leather, with tendrils of shadowy darkness undulating around his head. But the players didn't recognise him because the story required the use of a carbide spelunker lamp, which is the Call of Cthulhu's counterpart of the Bohemian ear spoon, a thing that gets funny every time you mention it. So it rather caught the tension of the scene. Bohemian ear spoon is a sort of pike from Dungeons and Dragons.
Ah, okay.
The shadowy form itself eventually turned up in another ring from another ring of obsidian-sounding stones in a game of Warhammer Fantasy roleplay as the Tenebrae, which was the big bad from one of my campaigns there. That campaign was, I think that was my favourite one, where it was mainly cobbled together from scary old telly shows that I saw as a kid, mainly Sapphire and Steel, and as well as a vivid memory I had of something that no one else appeared to remember, a standing stone with an eye opening and staring directly at me.
Oh, yes, I know that image.
Yes, it was with your help that I was finally able to identify it as a children's TV series called Escape Into Night, which is the cliffhanger from episode 5. But how I know that, considering it was on in 1972 and never repeated, and I wasn't born till 1974, is rather old, to say the least.
Some sort of strange psychic memory, yes. Yeah. Escape Into Night, something that many of us, as you say, from that Scarred for Life book from the 70s, we remember with particular horror, a very creepy kids show that we've covered on my other podcast, British Invaders, all about science fiction television on British TV.
Yes. Listen to British Invaders, Mega City Book Club people.
Thanks for the plug, Matt. Absolutely. Checks in the post.
Of course, it's also based on another 2000 AD story, which I'd used huge chunks of it in the plot. I thought I'd better leave that till after they'd finished the campaign before I gave it to them. And it's Judge Anderson the Possessed.
Yes.
Which is another Brett Ewins masterpiece, which I lent to them mainly because I like it, which is a good way of spreading the word of Tharg, and is another way of a reasonable example of playing another way of playing a judge character.
Yes, and you did wonder about the demon in this particular story of Anderson's, the Possessed, who goes by the name of Gargarax, I believe. And you did wonder whether this was a nod to role-playing games in themselves.
Yeah, I think it might be literally a Games Workshop universe.
What, the Gargarax's world might be a Games Workshop universe?
Yeah. The dimensional portal that Anderson goes through ends up in a weird universe with demons and monsters. And in Gargarax sounds rather like Gary Gygax, who was one of the creators of the Dungeons & Dragons game. There was a comic strip that ran in the Games Workshop catalogue called Caleb Dark by Alan Grant, John Wagner and Brett Ewins.
Oh, right, of course. Well, yeah, we know those names.
Yep, which featured the followers of another Chaos God who was subsequently deleted from the Games Workshop Chaos line, which was Malal, and his followers were called Doomed Ones.
Right.
Or exactly the same armour as the demon that Anderson encounters at when she first arrives in the demon universe. So perhaps it was just Brett Ewins being lazy, I'm not sure, but it's perhaps he was a doomed one.
Right, okay. But of course, as you say, that story, there's another great Brett Ewins Judge Anderson cover from that story, I think, on the prog.
Right, yes.
Okay, so that was, you know, again, another sort of horror story that you were able to use for creating the world in role-playing games. I know there was a couple more supplements that came out from Games Workshop for this particular system. Did you get hold of those?
Yeah, one was a campaign called Judgment Day, which is I never had it at the time because the other Games Master bought it and he forbade me to forget it.
Right.
Because I would have cheated. Which, but he eventually never ran it. And I get it
okay.
later. It looks pretty good, though. An epic with a classic Dread villain returning. It looked quite impressive. And there was the other campaign, which was Slaughter Margin, which we didn't play either.
Right.
I did have that one, but I made several attempts to start it, but it was quite frankly so boring and complicated that I never finished reading it, never mind attempting to play it.
Right.
A lot of extraneous background material that the judges have got no way of discovering, and it was just seemed to be an excuse to sell a load of floor plans, which weren't a lot of use because we never use miniatures anyway. So.
Right. Okay.
The very last gasp of the line was something called City Blocks, City Block, which was more floor plans, which even the bloke in the games, the usually enthusiastic bloke from Games Workshop, was dismissive about, because it was just a load of sheets of cardboard. So nobody.
Oh, right.
So that's how the Judge Dredd line ended. Not with a bang.
And have you carried on playing the Judge Dredd role-playing game?
Well, I actually wrote quite a large bit of the D20 system, which was the subsequent Judge Dredd game.
Ah, so tell us about that. When did that come out? Is that the Mongoose publishing one?
Yep, that was 2001 that first came out. I was involved with an online game of Judge Dredd. And we subsequently got recruited to write the background material for that. So me and John Caliber and several other people involved with that game came up with how I actually... I wrote the laws of Megacity 1.
Ah, okay.
That was actually my first published work, is writing the laws of Megacity 1, so follow that.
That was pretty good, pretty impressive. I hadn't realised you were involved in that at all. And this uses the D20 gaming system, which I'm not familiar with, obviously.
That was much too much dice rolling and remembering formulas and things. It didn't really work, unfortunately. So.
Okay, but again, is the Mongoose version still available, or?
No, I think that's out of print now. Because both the D20 system and the Traveller system are out of print because they've lost the license. But there's a new one coming out, which I don't know very much about at all, I'm afraid.
Yes, I'd heard there was a Traveller, there was a Judge Dredd role-playing game based on the Traveller system.
That's about all I know about that one as well, I'm afraid.
So if you were looking for the original Judge Dredd role-playing game, obviously you're going to have to go to eBay for it now, and presumably finding the box set with the cardboard cutouts and the dice intact is not terribly easy. I know I managed to get hold of the Games Master's book and the Judge's Manual fairly easily, but I suspect box sets are much more rare.
Yeah, I assume so. I managed to get the hardback book, which still has the cardboard cutout things still intact quite easily, but that was quite a long time ago. My box set has long since disintegrated into its component bits and been thrown away, and the Games Master's book quickly disintegrated into a loose pile of pages.
Yes, 80s binding. Mine is loose. It's got loose pages as well. It's a bit like the Titan books that we talk about from time to time. It's large format and the pages, they have a slightly tenuous grip to the spine.
Yep. The Judge's book is still quite intact, but the Games Master's book is quite literally a loose collection of pages now. So.
Oh, right. But of course, you know, as you say, it's got everything you need in the Games Master's book and the Judge's Manual to actually run the RPG. And it's also, we haven't really mentioned yet, it's sort of wonderfully illustrated with panels and pages and pinups from the prog. So if I list the interior artwork that it's got at the front of my book, it's like a who's who. We've got Brian Bolland, Steve Dillon, Brett Ewins, Carlos Esquerra, Dave Gibbons, Ian Gibson, Cam Kennedy, Mick McMahon, Kim Raymond, Cliff Robinson, Robin Smith, Ron Smith, of course, and Colin Wilson. So, you know, that's a formidable lineup.
Yep.
If you're going to be picking artwork, and I suppose they had their pick. And so particular pages where they want to illustrate something like a block war, we'll get a great Ron Smith panel of something from a block war. Or I noticed there's panels from Curse of the Werewolf, all sorts of bits and pieces throughout this book, and it's lovely to look at.
Yep, I think they had access to all the artwork that was available at the time, so they just picked what they wanted, and some of it's actually doctored as well. So at one point you've got a Mick McMahon body with a Brian Bolland head. It actually quite works, but it's the unfortunate SJS judge obviously became victim of some foul experiment.
Okay. There's even, you know, an excerpt from Brian Bolland's famous Dark Judges cover. There's Orlok the Assassin with Steve Dillon art. It's greatest hits artists and some of the greatest sort of panels and moments from Dredd used to illustrate the two books. So there it is. It's the role-playing game. Obviously, they're not available anymore. You have to go hunting on eBay to find them. Would you recommend it to role-playing, you know, gamers now as an interesting system?
Yeah, it's a pretty basic system, so it works very quickly. You don't get bogged down with lots of skill checks and things because you've got seven skills and one of them will cover what you want to do. So, and it's just a percentage chance of doing it. So, and it moves very quickly, but you do. It tended to get bogged down. We got stuck with the idea that you read out the action phases by slowly counting to 10, and you announce what you were doing when you had an action on which made things seem a bit clunky, and it was a very difficult habit to break. But apart from that, it worked very quickly, and you didn't have to work out all the skill checks and what have you.
Okay, and what sort of games do you play now in terms of RPGs? What's your favourite?
Well, I haven't actually played for quite a long time because I'm 43 and I'm a bit old. We've played quite a lot of RuneQuest during the day.
Right.
And Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition was what we graduated to, and then Call of Cthulhu and Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which was the one that we played as a... Because I actually brought a couple of characters through a dimension warp, and they all met the judges, which is a bit silly, but...
Okay, let's play the Grail Pages game. As I say, you've got beautiful artwork illustrating these two books that I've got in front of me. If you were able to choose an image or a page or something from these two books and I could provide the original artwork for you, would you be able to narrow it down and pick one?
All right, I'll need the book for this.
Aha.
There's a page from... On page 94 of the Games Master's book, there's a page from Cry of the Werewolf with the werewolf bursting through the door. I'd add that.
Yes, Steve Dillon. What a wonderful bit that is. Yes, Steve Dillon, some werewolf action, and it is fantastic. It is one of the standout images that jumped out at me from this book as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll give you that in the Grail page virtual art gallery of Mega City Book Club, which you can now find on the Facebook page. I mean, if we widened it out and you were able to pick something from the stories that you've mentioned from the prog, what would be your pick then?
All right. Well, that would be The Battle of Upminster is begun from Portrait of a Mutant in Prog 211, which is the second page of where the mutants launch their attack on the Battle of Upminster, which is probably cheating because it's my first prog, but it's the reason why I'm here. So I'd have that.
Oh. That's a great pick.
The splash page from the beginning of Cry of the Werewolf, with the werewolf emerging from the Undercity, or with the one with the renegade robots on page 5, episode 5, with Dread blasting through the renegade robots with his lawgiver. Or I've got lots of these.
Okay.
Grails, you know. The page at the start of the graveyard shift of Dread in the Watching Bay, where it goes on for miles and miles, which I impressed me enormously. So I'm not going to pick one because I'm going to cheat.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll allow you several, but particularly we'll give you that Steve Dillon werewolf image as your pick. I'm going to actually choose the front cover of the Games Masters book by Terry Oakes, who, as we've said, was a Games Workshop artist, White Dwarf artist, just because it's an image that I've never seen anywhere else. It's, you know, Dread and the judges riding towards you on Lawmasters, variation on a classic theme that we've seen on many a cover. There seems to be a city block or city building blowing up behind them. It's great stuff. And I don't know whether this artwork ever still exists, but I'm going to pick that as a wonderful image, and it will be the picture on the cover art for this particular episode as well.
Right. All the blocks exploding in the background is very impressive.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Okay, Matt, it's been fascinating talking about Dread role-playing games and your history with them. Now, I know, as you say, you've written for the Mongoose system for Judge Dread, but you've also written other stuff for some Judge Dread-related projects and publications. So it's guest projects time. Tell us a little bit about your other writing history.
I've been writing for Dog Breath and Zarjazz most recently.
Ah, okay. Yes, everybody's a big fan of Dog Breath and Zarjazz. Great publications from Future Quake Press.
Dave and Richmond from Future Quake sent out a request for Call to Arms, so I sent them in a Tales from the Dog Breath style narrative called Twilight of the Dogs. Which was initially 175,000 words, which they said was a bit long, so I cut it down a bit.
Right.
Appeared in Dog Breath 28. So I submitted some more scripts, and one called Scowl and the Pussycat, with starring Durham Red and Johnny Alpha. And then followed by a short one called All Time Low, which was filled with typos, but they accepted both of them anyway. But the first one to go to an artist was called The First Day, which went to a great artist called David Broughton.
Oh, yes, I know David.
Yep. He's a mainstay of the 2000 AD fanzines, and he's got his own great small press title called Shaman Kane. But the first one to get into print was a story called Silver Song, which was a comic rock, which was also by David Broughton, which people seem to like the artwork, but they weren't so keen on the words, which is never mind.
Okay.
I've got some more actually scheduled for when they're waiting to be scheduled, or they may actually be out, but depending on when this podcast comes out and when they get scheduled.
Yeah, okay. What you got coming up?
There's a Tales from the Necropolis tech story with artwork by someone called RoboMonkey147, though apparently he also goes by a human name of Darren. So,
okay.
Which is, this was written, I wrote that one for a tech story competition in the magazine, but I didn't send it in because it realised that when I'd finished it, that it was supposed to feature one or more of the Dark Judges and include Dredd or Anderson, but I'd written something about the Sisters of Death, so kind of broke the rules.
Okay, never mind.
There's also my first non-2000 AD related strip, a four-page story for Something Wicked called Hurt, which is some beautiful artwork by an artist called Eileen Arakian, who was a winner of a Top Cow the Top Cal Talent Contest. It's amazing work there, Matt.
Something Wicked is Future Quake's horror magazine, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure when that comes out either, so it's either coming soon or buy it now. So there's another thing, a few other things that have just gone to artists. Including my maddest script based on a throwaway reference in the 1989 Judge Dredd annual. So, you know, sometime in the future, we may see the adventures of Judge Fudge and his pals. So,
something to watch out for.
Yep. That's it, I think.
Excellent. Okay, so you've got some stuff in Dog Breath and Czar Jazz and also some stuff coming out in the upcoming months. And I will try and put links to Matt's work for those publications in the show notes for this episode when it comes out in September. So I think that's just about wraps us up, Matt. Excellent work.
Thanks.
And thank you to everybody for listening to Mega City Book Club. Please subscribe in iTunes or your favourite podcatcher. And if you feel like leaving us a review on the iTunes store, that will help push the podcast to other people can see it. You can find a complete list of all the episodes so far and of the books chosen for upcoming episodes on the Facebook page. Please follow the podcast on Twitter at MCBC Podcast and email me comments and suggestions to mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And as ever, you'll find all my links at megacitybookclub.com, the one place to stop to find out all about the podcast. And that'll do it. So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we're passing judgment on another fine 2000 AD publication, it's goodbye from me and...
goodbye.
Goodbye.